Welcome to Energy Unplugged. I'm Makeda. I'm head of research for Western Europe and India at Aura Energy Research. And I'm fortunate to be joined on the show today by Roisin Magyukyan, CEO of NTR. Welcome, Roisin.
Thank you very much, Mark.
Thank you for joining us today. And also Steph Unsworth, who leads the research on the ISEM at Aura. Hi, Steph.
Hi, Mark. Thank you for having me.
Good to have you here. Before we go any further, a good place to start would be to hear a bit more about NTR. So, Roisin, could you tell us about what you do and the type of project that you look at?
Sure. Yeah. So, look, NTR has been investing in the energy transition space actually for about 25 years now. But in the last 10 years, we've been doing it through funds. We focus on Europe. Typically, the investments we do would be renewable generation, storage, electrification enabling. We're in six countries around Europe: Sweden, Finland, France, Spain, Italy, Ireland, and the UK. And our projects will be everything from development, ready to build, all the way through to operational. We've just about 70 projects now in various stages of the life cycle.
That's a super interesting positioning. And the reason I wanted to discuss with you today is because I wanted to explore the topic of grid constraints, which is quite an acute problem in Ireland at the moment, but increasingly in all markets. And on this topic, to bring some of Aura's view on constraints, I have also invited Steph Unsworth. And maybe a good place to start, Steph, would be for you to tell us about the ISEM, since this is the region that you're looking after.
No, absolutely. So the ISEM is a bit of an interesting market because it covers the island of Ireland. So this means it's covering both jurisdictions of both the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland. So this means we have two governments, two regulators, and two system operators. So things can get quite complicated quite quickly. And because we are looking at two different countries, that means the transfer of electricity between the two regions is also fairly limited by a single interconnector, which is the north-south tie line. So this means that we get a lot of dispatch down on the market and a lot of system kind of constraints and limitations.
Thank you. And to steal your words, Roisin, from a conversation we had recently, Ireland is kind of the canary in the coal mine when thinking about grid limitations on so many aspects, actually, which is why it is such an interesting case study for today's discussion. And I suspect we need to lay out strong foundations for this discussion. And we should probably remind ourselves first of the semantics here. So Steph, could you explain what we mean by curtailment and constraints in the context of an electricity system?
No, absolutely. So within the ISEM, both of these things alongside oversupply are often referred to as dispatch down. But Dave will try and keep it simple with curtailment and constraints. So curtailment tends to refer to system-wide operational limits. So within the ISEM, an example of this would be SNSP, so the system non-synchronous penetration limit, which is effectively a limit on how many renewables you can have on the system at any one time as a proportion of your demand. And this is to make sure that the grid can run at a secure and stable level. Meanwhile, when we are talking about constraints, this is talking about the localized grid and network issues, which might cause turndown due to having renewables and demand slightly further apart from each other, and a reorganization or redispatch of your generation to help meet that local demand.
And so could you share with us a few numbers to understand the situation, I think, the magnitude of the problem, how much generation is being lost due to curtailment and constraints?
Absolutely. So last year, across the entire island of Ireland, we saw 12.1% of all renewables being either curtailed or constrained down on the market. This is even more pronounced in Northern Ireland, where we do have that pinch point due to the tie line, where we saw 26.4% of all onshore wind in Northern Ireland being turned down across 2024. So these are unprecedented levels and extremely high, even in a European context. And the kind of expected cost of just constraints over this tariff year is expected to be 450 million euros.
And now, thinking about investors in the energy space, Roisin, how does this impact remuneration? Obviously, we need to appreciate that this differs from market to market. This is a market design question, but we could use the ISEM as a case study to start with, and both for curtailment and constraints.
So, I mean, Steph paints a fairly bleak sounding picture, and obviously there are things we can do about it, but let's think about compensation to start with. So whether or not your power is being dispatched down for constraint or curtailment reasons will affect either will you get compensated or not, or indeed the type of compensation, how it's calculated. So currently in the ISIM market, no projects receive compensation for curtailment. And so that was stopped back in 2018, unless you were successful in the government auctions backed in the Republic of Ireland for RES 3, which is in 2023, or RES 4 in 2024. So for example, if you had a project which has a CPPA backing, that's not going to be eligible for curtailment compensation. But now if you move over to constraint, which is kind of that local node part that Steph mentioned there. So if you have a firm grid connection, you can receive compensation for constraint. But again, since 2018, all the grid connection offers that have been issued are actually non-firm grid offers. So they would not be eligible for payments for constraint. But there, of course, there's a bit of a catch in that. The system operator in the Republic of Ireland, called Airgrid, had to fall in line with EU directives. And in recent years, then they've introduced a thing called firm access methodology, which basically means that once a year, they'll take a look at your projects and they will assess whether or not they could be deemed to be firm. And the way they deem a particular grid node connection being firm is if the constraint levels are considered to be very low, like less than 3%. So kind of in a roundabout way, those projects could qualify to receive compensation for constraint. So it sounds quite complex. Now, look, if I just step back a bit, there is an EU-wide regulation that does require member states to provide compensation for dispatch down. And interestingly, here in Ireland, there is a court case that's kind of winding its way through the Irish courts, and it's been appealed actually up to Europe. So two producers in the market have taken on through the court system this concept of how it's been compensated. In particular, they picked up on things like, well, hang on a second, why should a project that has a PPA not be compensated when another that's part of an auction should? It is working its way up to a European level. So far, it has been found in favor of the producers, but it's been appealed. The general consensus is that at least some or part of their case will be favorably judged on. And if that is the case, that's going to be big news, not just here in Ireland, but actually there could be precedents then for other markets and how other regulators are looking at compensation for dispatch down.
You're just mentioning, obviously, the European Union, other markets, and it's probably like a good moment to pause and reflect on whether it's a problem elsewhere than the ISM. So, Steph, do you have like a view on the magnitude of the issue in other markets?
Yeah, absolutely. So to pull out a couple of different examples. So Spain is one market where we have a lot of solar penetration, so high res, also high demand, which is going to cause a lot of grid constraints on that system. In Spain, they refer to it as technical restrictions, and these costs have increased in an average rate of 48% per year, reaching a level of 2.5 billion euros in terms of cost to the consumer last year alone. Meanwhile, a little closer to home, in GB, they spent £1.7 billion on grid constraints last year. And because they are currently upgrading some of the key lines across major grid boundaries, we've seen that those lines have actually been reduced down to less than half of their nameplate capacity, which has only further worsened the issue within GB in the last year. Meanwhile, in Italy, we've seen some quite dire situations quite recently. In fact, only a couple of weeks ago, so the weekend of the 17th of May, we saw the TSO reduced all of the interconnector flows down from international interconnectors down to zero to deal with that res overgeneration, which was on the system, particularly around those pinch points where the interconnectors were coming into the region. So this is definitely an issue we're seeing Europe-wide.
And so, Roisin, in your view, how do you categorize countries with respect to the risk of dispatch down? Are specific countries kind of like watch out or also like safe bets?
Yeah, I suppose, in fact, Steph has already alluded to some of the features of the types of markets that you need to watch out for. So the types of features that you would look at to say, well, I need to be careful about this in terms of dispatch down. First of all, any markets that have experienced rapid growth in one clean power technology in terms of capacity is one area to look at. So, for example, Spain is a classic example of an awful lot of solar has come onto the wires, and it is now every time the sun shines, it puts it under particular pressure. The second is where you have low levels of interconnection or where you're effectively an isolated or islanded power system. It's not just the ISIN. Think of Cyprus, for example. They've got very high levels of dispatch down. The third is you may have interconnection, all right, but if you have next door to you another jurisdiction where the power prices are a lot cheaper, you can make see these floods, similar to what Steph talked about in Italy. But Northern Ireland is another very good example there, where there's a lot of Scottish power is being imported into Northern Ireland and there's no place for it to go. So again, what you're seeing is curtailment and constraints of wind in Northern Ireland when that happens. And any market where you've seen a poor program of grid firming investment would be a watch out place. Or any regions where you have a tight transmission corridor between the generations being built and where the load is at the other end. I mean, you would think that, for example, Sweden would be a good example for that. But actually, what we've noticed there is not so much about curtailment in there. It's been more in terms of negative prices, which I know you've covered in other podcasts.
And it's really interesting because it feels to me that just a few years ago, this was just not an issue anywhere, barring potentially Ireland. And this is increasingly becoming a risk in most markets. We mentioned GB, Spain, Italy, and others. Is this your experience too? Has the perception of risk due to dispatch down, so both curtailment constraints, materially changed in recent years?
Yeah, we've definitely seen it. I mean, look, I have an Irish accent. We're based here in Ireland, but even though we work in multiple markets, we would have been talking about curtailment here in Ireland, you know, 5, 6 years ago. And a lot of our fellow investors and other markets kind of go, what's your problem? You know, but we're going to know this is coming. This is coming. But even within ISIM, we've seen an absolute step change in the last year. It is partly due to new installation levels, but I think you're also seeing a variety of different factors, in particularly in Ireland, when it comes to things like interconnection. A new interconnector was added onto the island, so we're seeing a lot more imports. And indeed, MinGen, we'll talk about it later, but there's other factors at play. But when I look across to other markets in Europe, I think broadly it is what you're now seeing is supply of new renewable power has rapidly grown, which is all what we wanted and needed, but investment in grid supports has not happened at the same pace. And this is kind of the situation we're facing right now. It's fixable, but it's definitely a step change.
Yeah, absolutely. And how do you evaluate the risks linked to curtailment constraints when assessing a project?
Yeah. Okay. It's a mixture of science and judgment, is what I would say. So look, of course, you need to get your grid studies done. And when you're getting grid studies done, you really want people who have a very good understanding of the grid system in that market, right down to grid node levels. And you want an analysis of, you know, what's that grid node looking like? You're looking at where you're connecting on the node versus other projects. You're looking at broader market assumptions. You're looking at things like, okay, what other generation is likely to connect, but what works are planned by the TSO or the DSO in that node or broader around the place? And you're looking for a view when you're getting grid upgrades, reinforcements, et cetera. And then you apply judgment. And the judgment is, do I believe these grid reinforcement works are going to happen when they say and publish that they're going to happen? Do I believe that there's going to be delays? Do I believe that the level of investment is there? And you have to kind of put a view on when you think curtailment levels will flatten out or the extent to which you think they're going to continue to increase. So it's, as I said, science and judgment together.
And that's for new projects. When the project is up and running and facing into constraints or curtailment, do you have any experiences you can share on how to manage it at a tactical level?
Yeah. So let's take Scotland as an example. And this is one particular project where we did successfully manage the situation of constraint at a tactical level. This project had a non-firm connection, and we were being constrained down significantly more than was originally planned. There was an assumption as to when grid firming works were going to take place, and they weren't taking place in the allotted time. And what we did was we proactively sat down with the system operator and we worked together on a flexible load management system. So we said to them, you give us signals as to when you think it's going to get congested and when you think you're going to be in a situation where you need to constrain us down. And rather than switching us off, why don't we work with you and we'll step down and step down and step down in order to help you keep grid stability. And that's worked incredibly well for us. So rather than being completely dispatched down, what we actually ended up doing is being able to produce through these periods of congestion. It also had the advantage of reducing force trips, means that there's no kind of damage to the equipment. So that helps us. But equally for the DSO, it was also very helpful. I would say that particular project was located very close to the nearest substation. If there was a project between us and them, between the substation and us, I'm not sure it would have worked as successfully, but it is an example of how you can tactically manage for this issue.
And Steph, you've looked at a number of projects and investment cases. How does compensation feed into the risk level of different routes to market? And I'm also very keen to get, Roisin, your thoughts as well on that.
It's definitely an interesting one. So as Roisin kind of hinted to earlier, some renewable support schemes from the government, particularly in the ISEM, do cover some of your curtailment risk. And having that kind of compensation and remuneration for curtailment as part of those support schemes makes them a lot more attractive and reduces the risk for a lot of these projects. We've seen in the upcoming offshore wind auction we're expecting to happen later this year within the ISEM, this is actually going to cover both curtailment and constraints, which is massively going to de-risk that project and help bring that online. Meanwhile, some other routes to market, so something like a corporate PPA or a fully merchant route, if you don't have a firm connection, it's almost unrealistic that you're going to get any form of compensation or remuneration for those grid constraints or for curtailment. So this is massively going to impact the risk level via that route to market.
Just to what Steph said, of course, it's a critical part of the analysis that we make. And you know, she's outlined the various programs that are there. It's really important that you get a little bit under the bonnet. You could talk about a high level worth of, you know, you're going to get compensated in a certain way, but actually the way it's calculated will also be very relevant on a jurisdiction by jurisdiction basis. So we will take a combination of a view of how much we think we will be dispatched down, as well as what percentage of it we feel will be compensated. And then we take that as sort of a judgment call into the level of risk that we perceive arising from that. So as I said, it's kind of to my point earlier on, you do the analysis, but you also need to take a level of judgment as well.
And so thinking about what needs to be done to address this rising issue, Steph, what are the system operators' plans to alleviate this level of grid constraints?
It may come as no surprise, but one of the biggest plans is to expand the grid. So this could be the firming of those non-firm connections, which Roisin kind of referred to earlier. It could be building new lines. Those lines could have dynamic power ratings. They could be HTVC lines. So something a bit more advanced, which can help manage those grid constraints. It could be increasing the voltage of lines or increasing the capacity and doing upgrades in that sense. But there's also things which TSOs can do on a more local level. So with the example of the ISEM, as we kind of mentioned, there's a huge issue in Northern Ireland where you're importing power from Moyle, which can't get out. So some of the kind of region-specific things which the Irish TSOs are looking at is, can we reduce how much Moyle is importing into Northern Ireland? Can we expand and build up that tie line? can we bring on more frequency and reserve capable capacities onto the system, which can help alleviate some of the stability issues which are driving curtailment on the system. So there's definitely a lot of things, without getting too nerdy, which system operators are looking into doing.
So this sounds great, but Roisin, in your view, how much can investors rely on plans for grid updates as announced by TSOs?
There's always delays. So we always take a cautious view on the plans as they're published. And what I would say that Steph has pointed to, you could have things which would involve a huge amount of complexity and planning and objections and so on, such as a new transmission line. That's very different to maybe some firming works that you do on a substation. So we would look at them in slightly different ways. How complex is it? And take a view then as to what extent we think there will be a delay. I mean, delays, with the best will in the world of the system operators, you've got planning, you've got resources of people, you've got long lead items. Sometimes they'll go out to tender, the costs are incredibly high, they have to redesign the project, and then they're back into planning again. So there's a huge amount of reasons as to why things can get delayed. We've seen, in particular, Steph's mentioned it, the North-South interconnector. I mean, we've been calling, not we, the whole sector has been calling for this for 10, 15 years, and we're nowhere near, you know, getting into the ground on that. You're seeing delays on Scotland to England superhighways. We've equally seen lots of delays in local network firming in France. The one notable exception actually has been Sweden. It's the one market that I've been in where I've actually seen grid works being delivered ahead of target. Hopefully that will continue, but it's a big pinch of salt with all published plans.
It's a fair observation. And obviously at Aura, in those markets that are heavily impacted, we've done a lot of analysis on the topic. Maybe, Steph, could you explain the approach taken at Aura when thinking of grid upgrades in particular?
No, absolutely. So at Aura, we always try to take an independent view, typically conservative, and bakes in these kind of delays which we are seeing within the market. So having our own view outside of that of the TSOs. This will be a view of how we're expecting the network upgrades to occur, what network upgrades are required, where are we expecting capacity to actually come online beyond announced projects based on where it is most feasible to build these? Because obviously profitability of these assets is going to change locationally when you're talking about unremunerated constraints. So we're taking a very big project, looking at the kind of total network view of where's the demand, where the capacity, where the lines, and doing some very complicated flow analysis, looking into things like thermal overload and N-1 contingencies to build up our own view of how constraints are going to change over time. And also, what do we need to do to be able to reduce those constraints on the system?
Obviously, like reducing constraints is a big job. It will take years. So what can we do in the very short term? And I think something that I hear a lot is resorting to flexible technologies. So I wanted to get your view, Roisin, like how then is dispatch down shaping NTR's interest in flexible technologies?
Yeah, well, first of all, I'd say we're still big fans of the energy transition. We're not going to be chasing after conventional power, which I know is a flexible technology, but where we look at the opportunity is more around storage. And look, you can look at storage a number of different ways. Storage can be a real opportunity for investment in terms of short-term storage, ancillary services, help the immediate issues that you would have on the grid. Larger opportunity as we now see it is LDES, or long duration energy storage. We define LDES as being 8 hours plus. And the opportunity there, just as a revenue generator, is your classic capture the power that is going to be curtailed, hold on to it and put it and feed it into the grid at the time when it is needed. We are seeing a lot of European markets finally moving towards this next stage. And we're looking very closely at what technologies will work best for this. The key thing I would say about LDES is that the system operators ideally should be incentivizing people to deliver LDES where it's needed and not where the developer thinks it should be put, which is unfortunately where it is beginning to happen in some markets. So we would be very keen on actually it should be system operator led rather than developer led around that. Ultimately, also, the most efficient way for LDES to work from our point of view is that the system operator should determine how and when they need to use the LDES. So ideally, as project owners, what we should be doing is make it available and then they'll use it into the way that they best need it. And obviously then your sort of investment thesis should be around that. Hybrid projects, big word now, everybody's going hybrid around Europe. Not every market is ready for hybrid, just to say. So just because you have something co-located side by side doesn't necessarily mean to say it's a hybrid project. A true hybrid project is when you're saying, I am adding storage onto a generation technology behind the meter, and that they are both in some form or fashion being paid for by delivering power at the time when it is best needed. Not all markets are ready for that just yet, but it is coming to place. Spain is progressing. The Nordics actually have a favorable regulatory landscape. Ireland is in train, and there are other markets coming behind. But one thing I would say, hybrid projects in the vast majority of cases do need supports. We've done a lot of analysis of a lot of our projects to ascertain whether by going hybrid, will they be able to self-stand on their own? And typically they don't. It's only in the certain circumstances where you're seeing enough hours of really extreme volatility of prices, like a lot of negative hours and a lot of prices of 80 to 100 euros per megawatt hour on offer. So you need that level of volatility and you need enough frequency of those hours in order for a true hybrid project to work on its own without supports. So I think supports are going to have to be a key part of hybrid really being part of the future.
But what kind of support are you thinking about? Should governments be stepping in to provide enough incentives for flexible technologies to combat system-wide curtailment?
Yeah, I mean, it's that or invest in a lot of grid. You know, Europe has already said we need, 500 billion euros worth of investment to make our 40-year-old grid a little bit, more capable for where we stand. There is another way of doing that. It can be investing into grid, but it can also be to take a look and say, how do I avoid these huge levels that Steph mentioned earlier on in terms of compensation for curtailment? Oversupply is going to be a much larger issue. So you can either be on the back foot and be paying compensation, or you can be on the front foot and support. And by the way, I would say, let's take hybrid projects. It is provide them right level support that you are incentivizing delivery of power when it's needed. And that, to me, is a much longer term solution than the defensive position has been taken right now.
And it's a great segue to think about the future outlook of constraints and curtailment. We've obviously spoken a lot about the current situation and ways to mitigate it. If we bundle all this together, what's in store in terms of constraints and curtailment volumes over the next few years? Steph, could you share a glimpse of what our forecast at Aura suggests for the ISM, for instance, but also maybe for other markets?
On a very high level, across most European markets, we're expecting over the next 5 years a general increase in the number of constraints. We're expecting demand centers to grow, and we're also expecting renewable penetration to increase over time. And when it comes to planning and the grid connections and the thought process of bringing these projects online, that ship has sailed. They are coming online where they are going to come online in the next few years. And in terms of grid expansion in the next few years, it's very limited. We're not going to be expecting grid constraints to come down until we start seeing widespread expansion, or, as Rasheem mentioned, having a lot of storage come onto the system, particularly long duration energy storage. So I guess to give an example there, if we're taking Germany as an example, there's already a lot of data centers set to come online around Frankfurt, which is in the south, and there's a lot of offshore wind, which is expected to come online. And that's going to have to be in the north, since that's the only coast which Germany has. Without any kind of mitigations going in place, that is only going to get worse over time.
And that's a great point you make about demand and data centers. Obviously, we've explored solutions in terms of grid build-out, regulatory move, supply-side adoption, such as flexible energy. At its core, the problem is because there is too much generation on the one hand and too little demand on the other hand, and a grid too limited to carry that energy. Is there something to explore on the demand side? And especially, as you mentioned, with data centers, large energy users, can they be a solution to grid limitations? What are your thoughts on that, Roisin?
Oh, yeah. Look, I mean, what Steph's talking about going to happen in Germany is already happening in Ireland. You know, we have data centers that are now on a moratorium. They're not being allowed grid connections because the view collectively is that the demand is too high. They're about 20% of our load at the moment, expected to grow to about 30%. And yet at the same time, as Steph pointed out, we're looking at up to 20% worth of curtailment of clean power. So like, it's totally ironic. So actually we're working ourselves with some data centers and data center providers in Ireland. And we actually think it's quite exciting because if you get the right mix of clean power together with storage, put in an uninterrupted power supply solution with the data center, and you use the MIC and the MEC that the data centers have, and you inject back into the grid as the grid needs it, the data center can actually be a solution to this grid issue rather than be perceived to be a problem. So we got to kind of think about it and turn it on its head and say, these guys they don't use the load all the time. When they don't use it, there is actually an opportunity for them to inject back into the grid as the grid needs it. And I think there's a real opportunity there.
There's so many angles to look at this problem and to find solutions. And maybe one that I wanted to add to the mix. So considering that the situation will get worse, at least in the short and medium term, as Steph pointed out, on the regulatory side, what policy or market shifts could reduce curtailment risk and support the deployment of capital in new assets?
I've got a whole shopping list of things that they could be doing, but let's think about it. First of all, I mentioned it earlier on in terms of payments. Incentivize LDES where it's needed. Make payments for hybrid projects in such a way that you are incentivizing power for when it's needed, not at any time of day. In terms of the infrastructure, first of all, recognize that this is a critical issue. It's here. It's not coming down the line at us. It's actually here. And then start to look at planning for things like grid works, grid firming works, and so on as critical strategic infrastructure that should be fast-tracked when it comes to planning. And while you're at it, the balance sheets of the utilities are not going to single-handedly cope with the level of investment that needs to be made into all the high-voltage wires, for example. So allow private capital to contribute, to invest in, build, and manage these wires. I think that will be it. Oh, finally, I would say system operators themselves. Look, you've got to be accountable. You know, you publish a plan, you need to deliver the plan. If you don't deliver the plan, you should be penalized. And I think that would make a huge difference.
I love that shopping list. We're reaching the end of the episode. We've discussed the rising issue of curtailment constraints, how the situation will evolve, how to think about the risks for projects, but also what upsides it can represent and what solutions there are. I'd like to end with a series of very quick questions, not related to this specific topic, just to get your hot takes, Roisin, on the energy industry. First, what is the most overhyped technology at the moment, in your view?
Okay, well, I wouldn't try to speculate on what's most overhyped in terms of capabilities, but I would say the most overhyped in terms of opportunity for investing in commercial projects to invest in, I would say floating offshore and hydrogen.
And maybe second, in your opinion, what is the one thing that regulators must fix this year?
Okay, well, that's easy. Get more resources and speed up your decision-making and then just apply it across the board.
All right. Roisin, Steph, I'd like to thank you very much for this very enlightening discussion. And it's been a real pleasure to have you both in this episode today.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you, Mark. It was my pleasure.
That was Mark Edan, Aurora's Head of Research for Western Europe and India, talking to Roisin Magukian, CEO of NTR, and Steph Unsworth, who leads the research on the ISEM at Aurora. Thanks for listening to Energy Unplugged. Do keep an eye on our podcast feed for more in-depth conversations with senior members of the energy industry. The best way to do this is to follow the podcast via whatever platform you use.